Yeah, okay. Second try, I'll try to be a little faster to make up for the wasted time. So I started saying that this work is based mainly on a paper with Wolfgang Wieland that appeared this summer. And I have to say that Wolfgang has been really the driving force and the main contributor to the project, in fact, both in terms of ideas and calculations. And the good news is that he's out on the job market. So I strongly encourage you to consider him for hiring because he's really good. And to continue with crediting on page 2, I also would like to say that these results sit in the path of some ideas and papers that I've worked on with a number of friends and colleagues. This all started with working collaboration with Laurent, and then I worked on this for some time with Eterai, and also with now with Wolfgang, but also with Bianca, Carlo, and it's really a pleasure to thank them for having shared ideas and thoughts. And while mainly the talk is based on this paper with Wolfgang, there will be also some aspects which are taken from another paper, which will appear soon, and it's in collaboration with Miklos Langvik. And if you don't know him, he's a Finnish postdoc that you might have met at Lux 11 last year. So what I'm actually going to talk about is some recent results based on these Pistorius representations, which split in classical results and quantum results. And I will actually spend most time just talking about the classical theory for two reasons. First of all, because really understanding the classical theory is behind also what happens at the quantum level. So for me, that's the most important message to give. And the second reason is the quantum theory results are actually a bit technical, so it's probably easier to just convey the more intuitive geometric results of the classical part and refer it to the paper for the quantum part. So I will now try to continue a little bit faster. So let's go on page number 3, where I begin the classical part. And let me just check that you're still with me this time. No? Yes.
Go ahead.
You are still there now?
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Yes? No? No.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Ah, okay, great. Thank you. Okay. So, this first slide number three, I give an idea of what I meant by some of the classical results that I would like to discuss. So the starting point of quantum gravity, we take this Hall function in which we have connections and tetrad as independent variables, and these are objects which are valued in the Lorentz group of let's just say SL2C. Then there are the canonic analysis that shows the presence of simplicity constraints which can be solved by going to Hashteger-Barberio variables. Then the nice part of the Hashteger construction is to actually smear, produce covariance smearing in terms of holomism fluxes, which lead us to a pair of an algebra element and an SU2 group element associated to each link, which form a pair of conjugated variable in the synthetic manifold of the cotangent bundle of SU2, which can be seen as the building block of the classical theory once you talk in terms of the smeared variables. On the other hand, the spin-form formalism has been pushing for a slightly different viewpoint in which one smears directly the Lorentzian variables, so this is needed to construct the discretized path integral in a more covariant way, and so one ends up talking about the cotangent bundle of SL2C instead. And then the question is whether one can now impose the simplicity constraints and end up with the same T-star of SU2, in particular with the same non-trivial embedding of the Hashteger-Barbero connection in the Lorentzian connection. And this has been an open question for a while, concerning which some very nice progress has been made thanks to the EPRL model. And I'm going to focus actually on just the classical part of this question and show how twisters allow to very nicely formulate this question and show the, so to speak, commutativity of this diagram. Now, just to remind you a little bit of the structures involved here, you'll remember the simplicity constraints come in two, the primaries and the secondaries. And the primaries are rather simple. They impose simplicity of the bivectors or a unique metric structure. If you remember the seminal paper by Reisenberger on generativity is left area equal right area, basically imposing equality of the two internal metric structures of SL2C, one ends up recovering the structure of GR. On the other hand, the secondary constraints are more subtle because they involve derivatives, And basically what they tell us is that the spatial part of the connection is a function of the triad, and that allows us to understand how the Ashtekar-Barbero connection is embedded in the Lorentzian phase space, and so to give a complete geometric interpretation to our variables. So how about at the discrete level? The primary constraints, we understand them pretty well, and basically what comes out of our analysis is that there is a notion of simple twisters in parallel with the notion of simple bivectors, which is quite nice, and which is related to this discussion of linear primary simplicity constraints that has appeared in the APRS info model. And also, this discrete picture given by the twisted geometries shows a parallel with also the matching of left and right geometries, because again, we have a left and right twisted geometry, and the primary simplicity constraints that we'll recall later on select a unique version of them. On the other hand, the secondary constraints are under discussion, because their discretization can be proposed in different ways. In particular, we don't really have a derivation of the secondary constraints through a Dirac stability procedure of the primary constraints with a suitable Hamiltonian. So the question there is still under discussion. But what I'm going to do is that I'm going to completely sidestep the question of the secondary constraints. And how I'm going to do this is, if you move to slide number 4, the strategy would be that I will just consider the primary simplicity constraints only, and I will treat them as first-class constraints. So we just do symplectic reduction, and then think of the secondary constraints as providing a non-trivial gauge fixing for the orbits of the primary constraints. So this allows me to address the commutativity of this diagram, show it works, without actually entering the discussion of the secondary constraints, although I will later on comment on the secondary constraints and some recent discussions in the literature. So this is my way of cutting this Gordian knot for the moment. And the technique is to use twisters, namely the parameterization of phase space, Lorentzian phase space in terms of twisters and also of all the algebra of constraints. And this is not just cosmetics, it actually allows to do calculations in a very efficient way and very explicitly. So I hope this will become quite clear in the continuation of the talk. So slide number 5. I have a nice panorama of what I see is the situation at the moment for all this structure that I've been talking about in the last couple of years or that I will be talking about today. In particular, if you have heard any previous talks on twisted geometries, you might be familiar with the, let's say, central right part of this diagram, starting at open and going down and to the right. This was the structure I discussed recently, in which one starts with this parameterization introduced with Laurent of the phase space of loop quantum gravity in a fixed graph in terms of twisted geometries, which under closure condition gives you a map to a collection of polyhedra and does a notion of generalized regi geometries in which discontinuities are allowed. So what is new and what is the result of today is how this fits into a Lorentzian picture, and that's the top left part of this panorama. Namely, these twisted geometries can be either directly obtained from some SU2 spinners, and this was just a nice result, which is kind of, I used to say, a classical version of Schwinger's representation for the harmonic oscillator. But now, in fact, I have added this extra layer on top, which is that everything can be derived adding suitably simplicity constraints to fully Lorentzian structures that can be defined as covariant twisted geometries or, as I was saying, in terms of twisters. So this is the panorama, and what I'm going to focus on today is the top left box. But before I do that, for who doesn't know about twisted geometries, I have just one quick slide, so which is slide number 6. So I guess most of you are very familiar with this, so this is your time to check emails. And for the others, let me just briefly remind you what happens and why do we talk about polyhedra and loop quantum gravity. It's because we're actually pressed, so to speak, by the spin-form formalism in which we define transition amplitudes for the dynamics graph by graph. We're pressed to consider and take seriously the theory defined on a given graph before taking any superposition or continuum limit. And so we're trying to make sense of this truncation of the theory. So truncation in the sense that only a finite number of degrees of freedom are captured, which are typically interpreted as just some distributional configurations of an otherwise continuous gravitational field. The idea is that the same then it can be actually mapped into not a distribution interpretation, but rather interpretation in terms of discrete geometry. And this happens in three steps. The first step is that one takes the graph and considers a cellular decomposition dual to the graph. This doesn't need to be a triangulation. The graph can have arbitrary valency. Nice property of graphs that I will require are, for instance, that two nodes are not connected by more than one link. But generalization can also be discussed because the mapping that I propose is completely independent. The geometric interpretation, on the other hand, is more relying on a nice structure of the graph. So that's the first step. The second step is that instead of insisting on orthogonalism fluxes, which for the case of SU2 I'm denoting with the capital X and G, where capital X is the flux and G is the orthogonalism of SU2, one makes a change of variable from this six-dimensional space to another six-dimensional space, which is now parameterized in terms of these two unit vectors, N and N tilde. These are unit vectors, so they can be described by a point on the sphere, and a point on the sphere can be described with a stereographic projection by a complex number, and that's what I mean by zeta here. And these are four of the six variables, and the other two are a pair of what end up being canonically conjugated variables, which I call J and Xi. Xi is an angle, J is a real number, which upon quantization becomes the spin number. But here I just for the first part of the talk, it's all classical, so when I say J, I really mean just a real number that represents the oriented area. Or just, you can think of it just as the area and take J positive. So this is the second step, and then the third step is that now that you've mapped all these orthogonal flux into areas and normals, because basically that's what we're doing, areas and angles, you can use gauge invariance on the nodes to reconstruct a unique polyhedron around each node, and then use this collection of polyhedra to give a notion of tree geometry, which has many features in common with edge calculus. In particular, each bit is piecewise flat, and curvature arises at the hinges, when you go around the hinges. It also has, similar to edge calculus, a notion of extrinsic geometry carried by an angle xi, although it shouldn't be called for the moment a dihedral angle, we'll see later. But it generalizes edge calculus in different ways. Apart from the fact that the variables used are different, instead of edge lengths, one uses areas and angles, the important generalizations are two. First of all, it applies, as I said, to any cellular decomposition, not just triangulations. But more importantly, it allows for discontinuity in the matrix. So now when I go across a face shared by two polyhedra, the area is the same, but the shape doesn't match, as you probably heard a million times by now. So that means that in a sense, these geometries are more general than wedge geometries. And as the previous panorama pictures show, there exist shape matching conditions that we can write explicitly and that allow us to tell whether twisted geometry is also a wedge geometry or not. And these ideas go back quite a long time, because I think in around 95 already, in Easy and his modeling collaborators, they had proposed that there was a match, that there should have been a match between lattice classical gravity and its quantization and loop quantum gravity. And they were thinking in terms of edge calculus, and these results show that one needs to be a little bit more general in order to capture this kinematical degrees of freedom of spin networks. The matching becomes, on the other hand, exact in 2 plus 1, and there's a nice counting argument that will convince you, and you can see this on a recent review paper I wrote with Maite and Johannes. But the result for today is to show how this can be embedded in Lorentz structures, I promise you. So stop your emails now and come back with me on slide number 7, where I take a rather minimalistic viewpoint, and I forget for a moment about all these orthogonalism fluxes and graphs, and I just focus on a much simpler object, which is just a single twister. So let me remind you what a twister is, or at least one way of viewing a twister, which is going to be interesting for us. And this is to view a twister as a pair of spinners, so as a bispinner. Let's call them omega and pi, and these I take them to be chiral under Lorentz transformations. Now, if you don't like to think of twisters because you feel they're too complicated, you can also just think of these as a Dirac bispinner for the moment. I don't care. An object that is important that will play a role in the following is actually the Lorentz invariant construction that you can make out of these two spinners, which I'm calling pi omega with this index-free shorthand notation. And if you see something in terms of Dirac bispinners, these two Lorentz invariants are just the usual SL2C invariants, I should say. are just the usual psi bar psi and psi bar gamma phi psi. One of these two, with our convention, this turns out to be the imaginary part of pi omega, is not only invariant under SL2C, but it's invariant under a larger group, which is SU22, which is the conformal group or the governing of the conformal group of Minkowski space. So this quantity is actually conformal invariant, and this is what is called the helicity of the twister. So in fact, the reason why twisters are interesting in particle physics is that they carry a representation of the full conformal group, and so they carry the data of of massless spinning particles. And that's why they're very practical, because they're so compact and carry all this information. They're very practical to describe the scattering amplitude, as has been very fashionable in the recent times. But they also carry a geometric interpretation, which is extracted from what is called the Penrose incidence relation, which is the fact, which is this equation written in blue, where X is a generic matrix, and it so happened that X is Hermitian, or anti-Hermitian, depending on your convention, only in the case of a null twister, so when this imaginary part of pi omega is zero. In that case, since this is already Hermitian, this gives you a locus of points in Minkowski space, and you can immediately find out that this locus of space actually corresponds to a light ray. This is represented in the picture here. The light ray is a light ray that has the direction of the null pole of pi and goes through a point Q identified by the null pole of omega. So I think I have a, yes. Now, in the more general case, on the other hand, the interpretation is more complicated, because if the twister is not null, then X is a locus in complex Minkowski space, so you need to find a way to project it to something in real Minkowski space, and this gives rise to a very beautiful object, which is called the Robinson congruence. But it will turn out that we will not need this more complicated structure, fortunately. And one detail to point out is that actually this interpretation in terms of congruences, or just a light ray, it's not really capturing all the information about a twister, but it's just capturing the projective twister space, because if I make a complex rescaling of the spinners, it's the same geometric picture I'm giving. On the other hand, Penrose has been working on these objects in order to try to describe a version, a nonlinear version of the graviton, as he says, that is capturing the full non-perturbative degrees of freedom. And this is a construction that is very nice, but it's also very complicated, and I have to say only of partial success. And on the other hand, what we are going to see is that thanks to this connection with the loop quantum gravity, there's a completely different way in which these twisters can be seen as nonlinear gravitons, by being the classical counterpart to the quantum geometry. I'm pausing to drink. So, we can move to slide number 8. So let me give you a little bit more details about the link between twisters and our Ronomy flux algebra. So first of all, you might remember that C2 carries a representation of the Lorentz algebra, because C2 can be just seen basically as the celestial sphere. So what I'm after is some similar representation, which takes place on the larger twister space, which you can think of it as, just we said, as two spinners, so let's just think of it as C4 for the following. Then using these two spinners, I can write down a generator of the Lorentz algebra. I'm calling it capital pi, and this is just the left-handed generator, so the chiral SU2 subgroup, and which can be written using the rotation and boost decomposition as L rotation plus I k, where k is the boost. And A and B here are spinorial indices that go to, from 0 to 1. The mapping from this to the more traditional R3 vectorial index is just the Pauli matrices. What I mean by the fact that there is a presentation of the Lorentz algebra on twister space is the following. So I have this space, C4, which I can now endow with canonical Poisson brackets. So I'm going to take the omega A and pi B, have Poisson brackets given by delta A B, and if I do this, then the Poisson brackets of capital pi AB with capital pi CB reproduces exactly the structural constant of SU2, and the action of, so the Poisson brackets of capital pi on omega and pi gives a representation of the Lorentz algebra. So this is a Poissonian representation in particular. On the other hand, we're interested in something more. So this has been known since before I was born. It's the reason why, in fact, it's even larger than this. As I said, there's a representation of the whole conformal group, and it's the reason why this play a role in particle physics. But we're interested in something bigger than this, because what we care for is a larger Poissonian algebra, the one of the Olonifax algebra of SL2C. This is a space of dimension 12, where this trivial space has 8 real dimensions, so it's too small to accommodate for this larger algebra, so we need something larger. You might think this is complicated, but in fact, no, it turns out to be super easy. All you need is to take just 2 copies of twisters. So this is what I'm calling t to the power 2. So let's just take 2 twisters, z and z tilde. And this space is now 16 real dimensions. So it's large enough to have t star of SL2C inside itself, except that it's too large. So now I will need to do some reduction to extract the Godangian bundle of SL2C from it. So first of all, let's define the interesting variables for t star of SL2C. I already said the capital pi is a representation of the Lorentz algebra, so I can define the same object capital pi tilde for the tilded spinors corresponding to the second copy of the twister, and that's also a representation of the Lorentz algebra. So what I need now is an holonomy that will link the two via the adjoint representation and provide the representation, also of the Lorentzian holonomy. And this, surprisingly, will be done in a very nice way, and very, very simple, apart from this normalization that ensures that the determinant is 1, it's just a bilinear in the spinors. And it's just a generalization of the same object for SU2, which Ron and myself had introduced a couple of years back. And similar to the SU2 case, all you need in order to do the symplectic reduction is a single constraint, except that now it's complex, and it's first class, so it's 2 real constraints and 2 gauge orbits, so it reduces by 4, so 16 by 4, 12, the counting works, and you can actually check explicitly that everything else works, in particular the symplectic structure is recovered. The interpretation of this constraint, which I'm calling complex array matching for reasons that will be clear later on, it's basically the matching of the 2 helicities, the 2 complex helicities of the twisters. Okay, let's move on to slide number 9. So this is the symplectic structure. As I said, on the larger space, T2, I just take canonical brackets, pi and omega, I can think of them as position and momentum in this complex space, and in particular they commute among each other, and the reduction gives me this nonlinear space. So you see the beauty of this representation is that you can embed the nonlinearities of the Lorentz algebra into a fully linear space, and basically what I've done with the nonlinearities is that I've encoded them in this quadratic constraint, C. In particular, the momentum commute, which is nice, recovers the continuum version of the Hashtag-Barbero variables before the smearing. So let me now zoom on this box that I had on the top left corner of my panorama, and let's see what we are going to try to do now. I've just discussed how this green complex area matching condition reduces the twister space to the star of SL2C. Now the question is defining simplicity constraints that allow me to reduce to T star of SU2. And this I can do in 2 different ways. I can either impose the simplicity first, which I will define, and then the area matching condition, or the other way around. The system is actually so simple that you can establish all properties of this algebra of constraints. And there are 2 important properties that should be pointed out. First of all, is that really the order doesn't matter. It can go one way or the other at this level. And the second property is that the system is actually reducible. The constraints are not all independent among each other. I'll make it explicit in a second, but it should already be clear by the fact that in blue, the numbers in blue represent the dimensionality of spaces, and so by looking at these numbers, you should already guess that there is some reducibility in the space of constraints, and that's what actually happens. So let's go to slide number 10, where I define the simplicity constraint following Carlos' constructions of the primary linear simplicity constraints. Now, key to my analysis, to our analysis, is to work in a gauge-fixed approach in which a time-like direction is picked. Typically, it's the time gauge 1000, but it can be anything. This is important because another very nice approach to understanding this discrete smearing in terms of discrete geometry comes from work by Bianchi and Jimmy, in which they, on the other hand, use a gauge-invariant approach in terms of variables which are Reggie variables like the dihedral angles already defined at the level of gauge invariant, at the gauge invariant level. So it's important to stress. Because I'm working in a gauge fixed level, I have a norm, this financial pool norm at disposal, because I have the stabilizer subgroup of the Lorentz group that preserves this time-like direction. This allows me to introduce norms for the spinors and scalar product between the spinors as written in the second line, which are just SU2 quantities. Now, what are these primary simplicity constraints? If you remember the CPRL papers, these can be written in this fancy way as the boost plus the emergency parameter times the rotation equals zero, which is a fancy way of just rewriting the same thing, which is the fact that the left-handed generator pi and the right-handed generator pi bar are equal up to a phase, where the phase is just related to the emergency parameter. So here we recover immediately this Reisenberger picture. Left area equal right area, you see that the left-handed structure has to match the right-handed structure, so that's very nice. Now, these, as I said, I have generators for, on each link, I have left invariant vector fields and right invariant vector fields connected by the joint representation by the holonomy, and these are the tilted spinors and the untilted spinors. And so these are constraints for the untilted spinors, but I can also write constraints from the tilted spinors. And it turns out that I can impose them independently. This doesn't overdo anything. But this introduces some interesting restriction on the holonomies, which are crucial to show that the holonomy is actually, the reduced holonomy is actually the Hashteger-Barbera holonomy. So here we see, these constraints can be split. So these are three constraints on each half link, and they can be split into a Lorentz invariant part, which is just the Casimir relation between Casimirs of the Lorentz group, and two non-Lorentz invariant parts. And here we see a first powerful aspect of working with twisters and spinors is the fact that this decomposition can be done very elegantly and very immediately. The Lorentz invariant part can be written directly in terms of the Lorentz invariant, which is this pi omega contraction. For short time notation, let me call capital R its real part and capital I is imaginary part. So the Lorentz invariant part is just this relation that the real part is to be equal to gamma times the imaginary part. The non-Lorentz invariant part also can be written very nicely, and it can be, these two constraints can be encapsulated in a single complex constraint, which is nothing but the SU2 scalar product of the two spinors. So we see immediately that it's non-Lorentz invariant. Further explicit things you can learn about the system of constraints is the fact that the system is second class. The area matching condition C, which I'm sorry now is called M, but what I mean is C, is first class. The Lorentz invariant constraints F1 and F1 tilde are first class. The only guys that are second class are these complex F2 constraints. And here I, little I, goes from 1 to 2 is just a short annotation for each half link set of simplicity constraints. And they're also reducible, as I anticipated, in the sense that if you already are satisfying F1, then M will automatically imply F1 tilde. That means that there are only three independent first-class constraints, which you can pick up as you wish, depending on in which order you want to go around and solve the system. These are either the area matching condition and then the diagonal part of F1, which is of F1 and F1 tilde, the sum, or you take both F1 and F1 tilde, and then you have only a single reduced area matching condition. And then you have four second-class constraints given by F2 and F2 tilde. So we can move to slide number 11. So I have the system of constraints, and now you can do the counting again, going one way or another way, using the fact that some of these constraints are first class and some of these constraints are second class. Let's not forget that I'm completely neglecting, as I promised at the beginning, the existence of secondary constraints, which I would expect they would change the nature of the simplicity constraints. They might turn them into second class as they do in the continuum. But as I said, the strategy here is that I don't care about them, I just impose simplicity reduction, and then we speak about secondary constraints later on. So, because I've wasted some time talking to myself for 10 minutes, I wish not to give you this explicit counting, because it's very simple, you can convince yourself pretty quickly, and I would like to move immediately to slide number 12, where I show you how using these spinors you can actually give explicit the solution of the simplicity constraint. So as I said, they can be imposed independently on each half link. So let me focus first on half link only. So I'm only taking a single spinor, that is a single pair of a single twister that is a single pair of spinors, omega and pi. And in the brackets, I recall you that there's these two constraints, F1 and F2. Okay. So let us first look at the box in this slide. So I have three constraints, the effect of which is actually to impose the proportionality of the spinors. This is easy to prove. It tells you basically that pi is proportional to omega, where the proportionality coefficient is real. That is, the reduced five-dimensional space, 8 minus 3, five-dimensional space, is parameterized by just one of the two spinors, say omega, plus a real number, which I'm going to call J for reasons that, of course, will become clear later on. And now let me say something quite subtle and quite important, which is the structure of F1, because we said that F1 is first class. So as a constraint, what it does is tell us that it's this relation for the Lorentz invariant star. So it just tells us that pi omega is this linear combination of gamma plus I and then J, a real number. But more importantly, because it's a first-class constraint, I need to reduce, divide by the orbits it generates. So I need to know what these orbits look like. And it turns out that these orbits can be parameterized using the SU2 norm of omega, as in the second bullet. Then, if I'm interested in synthetic reduction, I need something that is invariant under these orbits. And this I can do by introducing an F1 gauge invariant, so to speak, spinner, given by this Z. This particular combination satisfies the constraints, and it's invariant under the orbit generated by F1. Therefore, this Z is actually the parameter on the symplectic reduction of the phase space. So it is the spinor parameterizing the four-dimensional C2 space obtained by symplectic reduction. And it is an SU2 spinor, as will be clear. So let's move to slide 13. I will comment on the simple twisters, which is in red here, later on. Let me now stick with this flow of discussion and move to slide 13, where I remind you again this box that I'm interested in. Now, in terms of the explicit variables, we go back to the picture on the full link. So I have two copies of this twister space and two copies of the simplicity constraint reduction. So I end up with two SU2 spinors, Z and Z tilde. Now I have the area matching condition on the simplicity constraint surface, where Fi is equal to 0 and Fi tilde is equal to 0. Part of this constraint is already satisfied. We said earlier on that it's reducible, the system. And what I'm left with is nothing but the area matching condition that I introduced with Laurent 2 years ago, and which we have already proved that gives you precisely T star of SU2 parameterized by fluxes and holonomies. So now the question is, what do we learn? What we learn is how this T star of SU2 exactly fits into the SL2C Lorentzian structure. And in particular, the flux, the SU2 flux, is nothing but the original rotation, as we would expect, because this is to satisfy this funny relation with the boost. But more non-trivial is that the holonomy, with respect to the, so this SU2 holonomy is with respect to the SL2C holonomy, it's some non-trivial object that is non-trivially embedded and that depends on the music parameter in particular. So it is truly lattice version of the Ashtekar-Barbero connection. The proof of this uses this relation on the connection induced by the simplicity constraints, which I'm recalling here. And roughly speaking, it might look like the final equation I wrote. But I would like not to enter the details of this proof, because it's a very nice proof, but it takes a few steps in which one uses the some type of interaction picture in order to disentangle the real and imaginary part of this dual connection. And I will just refer you to the paper for that. Instead, I will try to give you a more geometric intuition of what is going on and how this embedding is taking place. And to do that, I'll move to the next slide, which is slide number 14. So let me talk about the geometric interpretation. If you are familiar with twisted geometries, you will remember that a key object there is this angle, which we call the little xi. And so in this quiet picture, there is also a key object that carries a bit of the heart of the construction. And to keep up with the tradition, we're just going to call it capital Xi. So what is this capital Xi? I will introduce it in a second. because what I want to tell you first is that in order to talk about the star of SL2C, we assume to be already on the area matching surface. So C equals 0 is being satisfied. So the only first class simplicity constraint is this diagonal one, the sum of the two. And you remember that I told you the orbits of F1 were the norms of omega. So now the orbits of F1 plus F1 tilde are actually the ratios of the norm of omega and the norm of omega tilde. Why the ratios and not the product is just because of the way we've chosen the Poisson brackets. It doesn't really matter. You can choose otherwise. Everything is consistent. It's just different conventions. So for commodity, I'm going to take the logarithm of this ratio. And this quantity parameterizes the orbits of the diagonal simplicity constraint. Now what is cool about this quantity is that actually, thanks to the time gauge, you can show that this quantity is nothing but the dihedral angle. Why? Because you can take the time gauge normal at the starting point and at the ending point of the link and compute the scalar product, and you end up getting precisely the hyperbolic cosine of psi. Not this hyperbolic cosine, because this is an angle between two time-like vectors. So we get this interesting result, I would say, that the dihedral angle, the 4D dihedral angle, parameterizes the orbits of the diagonal simplicity constraint. By parameterizes the orbits, what I mean is that as you change it, you move along an orbit. I don't mean that as you change it, you change orbit, okay? It's in that sense. If we do symplectic reduction, we're basically throwing it away. So we're throwing away the information about the extensive geometry. So how is this going to work out? How is the reduced SU2-Olomy going to capture the extensive geometry as we would like it to do, as the SU2-Ashtegger-Barbero connection does? Precisely as the Ashtegger-Barbero connection by re-embedding it into the SU2 structure. And to see this, let's move to the next slide, 15, where I need to give you a little bit more details. And so I need to introduce an explicit parameterization of the geometrical variables, which could be called a covariant version of twisted geometries. Some bits of these are the same as in twisted geometries, and some bits are more Lorentzian. Again, I stress this geometric interpretation uses heavily the time gauge, and can be discussed the relation with Bianca-Zengini's construction. And so what I'm going to do is that these 12 variables, pi and capital pi and omega, sorry, and h, I'm going to map them into, so to speak, covariant twisted geometries variables, which are written in this green box. One of them, one complex, so a pair of real variables, is just this Lorentz invariant pi omega. Then zeta here is the same zeta that I would be using in the standard twisted geometries. It is the off section. It's the off section of the omega spinner. This is the convention we're working with. Alpha, it's a quantity that you can take directly to be proportional to F2, the non-Lorentz invariant part of the constraint. And finally, we parameterize also in terms of psi, and the capital psi, which I told you a second ago, is the fitted dihedral angle. And now comes the key part. I will introduce a little psi, which, as you can see, it's given by a relation between the covariant phase space, variables like the arguments of the two spinners, and psi, and this relation depends on gamma. And so this relation between the SU2 psi, little psi, and the capital SL2C psi should already remind you a little bit of what happens when you do the canonical transformation. It is a canonical transformation, by the way. And it should remind you of the canonical transformation that you do in the continuum from self-dual connection to Ashtegger-Barbero connection. So let's see what happens. If I introduce these variables, pi omega, z, zeta, zeta tilde, and so on, I can parameterize the holonomies and fluxes of SL2C as in the left box of this frame. In particular here, n of zeta is the off section for SU2, and this P of alpha is just the matrix made by 1, alpha, 0, 1. So this is a subgroup preserving the null direction 1001. And alpha is a complex number, as you can see by its definition. So this is actually the parameterization of the chiral Lorentz generator, and H is the parameterization of the Lorentz holonomy, which, as you can see, involves both little psi and capital psi. Now what happens when I impose the simplicity constraints? First of all, let us look at the simplicity constraint surface, so without dividing by the Gage orbits, I'm going to, you can see immediately that alpha and alpha tilde will be zero because they're just proportional to F2 and F2 tilde. And then the other constraint is related to this R minus gamma I, you know, which I told you already. And the result is that the flux immediately reduces, sorry, the capital pi, the Lorentz generator, immediately reduces to the H2 flux, as I anticipated before. What happens to H is that H reduces in form, because now T of alpha and T of alpha tilde just become the identity, but it's still a complete SL2C group element, precisely because of capital Xi, which, as you can see, is multiplied by I, so we still are dealing with a complete SL2C group element just in this rotational boost, rotational parametrization. However, when I do this impacting reduction and I divide by the Gage orbits, one way to do this is to just throw away Xi, for instance, I recover precisely the twisted geometry parameterization of the SU2 group. So all of this is to just hopefully try to give an intuition that there is a way to capture at the discrete level the non-trivial embedding of the Ashtekar-Barbero connection in phase space, which is given by this relation, this canonical transformation between little Xi and capital Xi. Okay. A little more on this, because I think it's quite a nice part on the next slide, although this is a bit technical, maybe you can pause for a second and come back, but if you're still interested, I can just briefly tell you that if you use this parameterization I just introduced, and you throw it in the symplectic potential of the star of SL2C, you end up with a structure of which I'm going to be interested only in the first two pieces. The derivative, the differentials of capital Xi and little Xi. The rest is just standard stuff that includes the non-commutativity of the boosts and rotations. This part here, you can see it has been, it's like an abelian substructure inside the Tissot of SL2C that can be extracted thanks to this parameterization. And this is just exactly mimicking what happened at the level of SU2 when Laurent and myself introduced similar ideas for the twisted geometries. And in particular, you can see the role of gamma very, very clear here. Without gamma, little xi and capital xi would be conjugated to the real part and imaginary parts of this complex area. And it's gamma that tangles the two, giving rise to a non-diagonal structure. On the cosine surface, we recover the canonical conjugation between little xi and j that you already know of. And so, this canonical transformation between little xi and capital xi is what I would like to sell you today concerning these covariant twisted geometries. It's, I think, one of the geometrical aspects which are more useful. Now, to finish this part, let me move to slide 17 and come back a second to, I briefly mentioned this, but the simplicity constraints also give rise to an intriguing notion of simple twisters. So what is a simple twister? Is this object that basically is parameterized by an SU2 spinner plus this dihedral angle, or equivalently by the omega spinner plus the scale J? But what is it in terms of the standard geometric interpretation of a twister? So first of all, in the literature, simple twister is used in a bit of a misuse. It's used to refer to actually the simple bivector built from two twisters, which characterizes a point in Minkowski space in our library. So here I'm introducing a different notion of simple twister, which refers to a unique twister. So let's go back to the incident relation. And I reminded you earlier that this represents a light ray if and only if the twister is null. Now what we have is, I said, a relation of proportionality between the spinners imposed by the simplicity conditions. This is the second equation here. And in this equation, R is just this coefficient of proportionality, which it's a shorthand notation for this combination of J, which is written to the right. J is the real object, the interesting object. N is the time-like direction which I need to choose for my gauge fixing. And theta is, again, this function of the energy parameter. So unfortunately, the spin, the twister is not null because of this F1 constraint, which recall, I remind you, told us that pi omega is equal to gamma plus I j. So in particular, the elasticity of the twister is j, is not zero. So this might mean that we might be needing to discuss about these much more complicated Robinson congruences, but in fact, no. The situation is simple enough, because although it is not null, is just a very simply isomorphic to an altruist. You can see it, all you need to do is to reabsorb e to the I theta into the second spinor, and you end up having an out spinor now. So basically what that means, the picture to the right, is that in twister space, you basically have the simple isomorphism between the two. So that's what F1 does. How about F2? What F2 does is that introduces in the game, in this interpretation of the twister, the presence of a fixed time normal, which forces the two null poles, the one built from omega and the one built from pi, to actually adapt to the normal. So we're not talking anymore about a light ray, but we're actually talking about the light ray that's been cut, so to speak. And we're just talking about two null vectors that they add up to a time-like vector. And in particular, this also implies that the two vectors are basically related by a parity transformation. So in a sense, they are antiparity, one is equal, the spatial part is equal to the minus of the other one, and the time-like part and the time component is the same. And also this implies that the flags of the two spinors are also related. And they're related, interestingly enough, by a rotation precisely by this angle theta that captures the Mirzi parameter. So basically, a simple twister, which is what we use, is just a gamma null twister, we would call it, with a time-like direction picked up. And the rest is just a comment on the projective space, but this we don't need to discuss here. We can then move to the next slide 18, where I just summarize. So this we already mentioned in a paper with Johannes and Iterai, this idea of twister networks, by which you take this graph, you assign a twister on each half link, and then impose these area matching conditions on the links, and you recover, and then you impose the gauge invariants are the nodes, and you recover twisted geometries or loop quantum, or the classical phase space of loop quantum gravity, if you want. Okay, so slide number 19, where I have some further comments and questions. So first of all, as I said, the twister space carries a representation of a larger group, SU22, the covering of the conformal transformation in Minkowski space, and that immediately means that you can actually study the action of this group and see what happens. And interestingly, there's a non-trivial effect on this geometry, which is a bit unexpected, and I will not tell you what it is, so you will be looking up for the paper that will hopefully finish soon in collaboration with Niklos Langwick. But more interestingly, and more referring to a paper that you can actually already read on the archive, concerns the secondary constraint. I promised you that I would say something about the explicit form of these constraints. So it is an open problem because we don't really study the stability condition of the primary constraints. But on the other hand, it has been done in the literature, and we can do it, to assume that they correspond to discretization of the continuum secondary constraints. These are the condition of torsionlessness, which implies that the spatial part of gamma is gamma of E. Yang and Jimmy notably studied this condition at the discrete level, and used the fact that the solution, which is the Levi-Civita connection, is well known in the context of Regge calculus. So they said, let's introduce the shape matching condition so that I know what this connection looks like. So in this respect, one interesting question that Bianca, Jim, and myself have been debating for a while is, do you really need to force the shape matching conditions in order to define a notion of torsionlessness and in order to define a notion of Levi-Civita connection? And this has been beautifully answered in the affirmative in a paper that just came out yesterday by some unknown people. I don't know them. They apparently are my friends here. So they've written this very nice paper, which actually I invite you to look at. And the open question at this point for me, this issue on the secondary constraint, it's one of the very interesting open questions. And of course, this paper provides important feedback. But the key open question is whether the shape matching conditions are needed in order to understand the classical dynamics of these geometries. If we post shape matching, we know how to give dynamics using the Regge equations. If we don't, is there a consistent dynamics we can write? Bianca, are you there? Maybe I'm still alone since a long time again.
No, it's okay.
Okay. Too bad that Bianca is not there because we've been also with her debating this aspect. Bianca, are you there? Okay, great. So Bianca, if there is a consistent dynamics, you will buy me dinner in an expensive truffle restaurant. And so if anybody has any ideas or wants to team up, I'll be happy to collaborate with them and buy them a sandwich or something like this, or a piece of truffle. I think this is one of the key questions at this stage. And in particular, there are some sub-questions related to it, which is whether the shaping dispatch plays any role at the dynamics or is just some accident that we really would like to get rid of, and if the torsion can be encoded in a little psi alone. Okay, that ends my classical part.
Yeah.
And I think I can maybe give you 5 or maybe 7 more minutes if you're patient, because I wasted so much time at the beginning, I'm sorry, and just say a few things about the quantization. Is that okay?
I think there was a question.
Ah, great.
So I have a comment on the simplicity, on the secondary simplicity constraints. So actually with Jimmy in the second paper, we looked at the gauge fixed version of the primary and secondary simplicity constraints. And we had this discretization of the secondary, which is basically the discretization of the continuum in the sense that self-dual plus anti-self-dual Ashtika connection gives the Levi-Civita. And these actually imply, at this point we were discretizing also the Levi-Civita, but in 3 different ways because of missing shape matching. And so in this way, the secondary simplicity constraints impose the shape matching. So what's happening in this new paper is really that some kind of average is taken of these 3 different Levi-Civitas. So actually it seems you can survive without shape matching.
Yeah, no, that's right. In fact, so of course this is very interesting to discuss. So the main difference at this point is really in the choice of variables, in the sense whether using these thetas that depend on the edges as you do, or whether using this discontinuum matrix as this fantastic 4 here in Marseille did. But I think it's, yes, that's right. The result in your paper are also very nice. I should have mentioned that. Apart from the comment, you had a question, or I can just go on and...
Go ahead.
Okay. We move to the quantization part. So the quantization part, I would just try to give you a snapshot of the novelties and the results. So there are some interesting ideas that come out of this description there too. So I'm now on slide number 20. The first idea that comes out of it is the fact that instead of working with the usual representation in terms of cylindrical functions for the Ashtika-Barbera holonomy, one can actually work with somewhat simpler functions, which are just homogeneous functions on spinor space. These carry directly a natural unitary and infinite dimensional representation of the Lorentz group, and in particular, they carry through the aspect that the variables that depend on, which is a single spinor, are commutative both at the level of the multiplication and the derivation operator. So there's some nice things that can be studied using this different representation. And I don't have much time to go into the details, but if you just look at the last line, the solution space, this is what you would have in the place of the Wigner matrix for the cylindrical function. Is a function that depends on one spinor only, one at the source and one at the target. The reason for not taking omega and omega tilde, but omega and pi tilde is not too relevant here. And its form is just the product of two functions, which are homogeneous functions in this representation of the Lorentz group that I quickly mentioned. So let me go to slide number 21. To say why this is interesting. So first of all is that it carries a representation of the full holonomy flux algebra, but now in a different way. In particular, the fluxes are obtained as the Schwinger representation of a self-2C. And the holonomy now becomes a less important operator, in the sense that now the more natural operators are the quantization of the twisted geometry variables, particularly these angles, whose geometric interpretation is much nicer, if you allow me, than let's say the 0-1 component of the holonomy. So this is an interesting direction to explore. In any case, you might feel safer in recovering the standard representation in terms of holonomies, in terms of just cylindrical functions, and this can be done. And quite nicely, this can be done with some type of kernel that maps you this capital G representation into the standard Wigner matrices, D, on the right-hand side. And this kernel can be written as an integral in twister space. So this means two things. First of all, that I can map this representation in the standard geometrical function representation. And second, because these Wigner matrices are basically the building blocks of the EPRS info model, as is briefly recalled below, that also means that I can represent the EPRL model as an integral in crystal space. Now, I'm not going to give you any details of how you prove the equation in the box. If you move to slide 22, I will just briefly tell you that the two key ingredients in order to prove this is a definition of the measure of the Liouville measure of crystallographic circuits as a measure in crystal space, which we did. And the second step is a representation of the BF action, which you can see exponential of BF action is what you need in the kernel. And this, I'll just make the brief comment that it's very nice in terms of the spinors because once again, it's just a bilinear. And for the actual proof and details, I refer you to the paper because I would rather tell you what we learned from this analysis. So on slide number 23, because we learned quite some interesting things. The first of all is the fact that you can express the EPRL dynamics as integral in crystal space. That's very interesting. However, if you now rewrite everything in terms of a single total action, as in the second equation of this slide, the single total action doesn't really carry an interesting dynamics. The interesting regio dynamics, in fact, comes at the saddle point, and it comes in a certain way from the interplay between these bulk holonomies, the G, and the boundary phase space variables. And point three explains what we have understood about the way the regio analysis, this data fit into the phase space. Point four just quickly recalls some other things that we have understood. But what I would really like to spend the last minute on is the fact that this points in an interesting direction as far as I'm concerned, which is similar to what I was saying earlier on, which is can we rewrite the model in a fully same model or a small modification, but in such a way that it's explicitly covariant, what I mean fully coherent. And what I mean by this is the fact that both spinors carry an interesting dynamics. All k-space variables are treated on an equal footing and not as it is right now that the areas don't come from the phase space that come from the spins, which are then summed over by definition. There's a long history of papers that have been trying to point at this direction. Daniele, Gramme, Deva, and Tender, Ram have been writing along these directions, and I think this historical presentation can also bring new lights. And finally, to conclude, I have some comments, some further comments about this total action. What could be interesting is that this total action represents immediately a discretization of generativity, which has two properties. First of all, the generativity in the first order formalism, as we started. And second, a priori, maybe there's no leadership matching conditions. This is, of course, to be discussed. But the reason why this is interesting is so that this semi-classical limit on a fixed graph becomes much more straightforward, and not needing this holonomy saddle point, which also recently has been questioned by Frank, by Claudio, whether it really applies on a full triangulation and so on. It is true that having a more clear control, whether the calculations really test an interesting semi-classical limit or not is a different question, but certainly having a more transparent formulation of this path integral would be very useful to me. And it goes back also to what I said at the end of the first part, because in order to do that, you need basically to have understood if there is a dynamics for twisted geometries. Now, just to finish, I'm not saying this is necessary. Of course, we might have no control really on the dynamics on a fixed graph, and then generativity just still comes very nicely when we take the continuum limit or superposition of graphs. But if this is the case, we need to know that there's a negative answer. And in any case, it is a bit disappointing that while lattice gauge theory there are a large number of possible discretization of the dynamics, we only know basically one regio calculus for generativity. So if there's a second one out there, it would be extremely interesting to know. And basically that's all I know, so that's the end of this talk, and sorry for running over time.
Questions?
Yeah, I have one question. Can I? It's Daniele from AI. So thank you, Simone, for all this. It's very, very interesting. So only one comment on the last slide. So I agree with all the open questions you write and the remarks. Only to point out that we have some answers to the first question, whether we have we can express the dynamics, the spin form dynamics as integrals over phase space. And that's both, it's in the later papers by myself and Aristide. In one version, of course, we're not using twisters, we are directly using the holonomy flux algebra phase space. And before, there were earlier papers by Etera and Valentin, basically proposing the same type of discrete actions on phase space appearing in a covariant path integral for the spin form amplitude.
More questions?
Well, I have two very general questions. So one of them is any connection between this work and the work of Freddy Cajazzo and collaborators expressing recently the gravitational scattering amplitudes in terms of twist functions on twister space.
I'm really sorry, but I wanted to bring the volume up and I hung up. I'm brilliant. Daniele, can you repeat your question quickly, kindly? Or just insult me?
No. It was, I was saying that I agree with everything you wrote. And I was having only a comment on the last slide to point out that not for the twister phase space, so without using the twister construction, but using directly the holonomy flux phase space, we have some path integrals, some path integral formulation of the spin-form models, both in the work with Aristide, and earlier there have been very similar proposals and constructions by Etera and Valentin.
Yeah, absolutely. No, but these are the papers I'm referring to. In fact, the question is there too. If you now take this action and you study its dynamics, is it regge? Is it not regge? Does it reduce to generativity? This is what I'm trying to understand in this formalism now.
Yeah, that's why I was only adding this comment. I was not criticizing at all.
Okay, and when you were off the phone, Lee had a question.
Okay,
so let me reformulate it. There's recent work of Freddy Cajazzo and collaborators expressing the full tree-level graviton scattering amplitudes as functions on twister space. And they take an interesting strategy where they try to do things as naturally as possible conformally invariant and indicate explicitly the breaking of conformal invariance in terms of the infinity twister. And I'm wondering two questions. One, if you see a relation to that work, and two, if there might be a natural gravitational theory expressed in terms of your twistorial variables, which was conformally invariant, and one could try to get general relativity back from breaking that conformal invariance.
Right, so in slice number 7, I mentioned that only one of the two Lorentz invariant is also conformally invariant, because this is also another way of rephrasing the same thing, that there's part of this crystal space that breaks the conformally invariant, in fact. And the way, but before going to this, there's a very important difference, which is the fact that in that construction, which is very nice, the twister played the role of capturing data of masslessness particles at infinity, where infinity is flat Minkowski, asymptotically flat infinity. But here, in a sense, the twister are brought to a local picture. I don't use them to describe asymptotically data for the moment. What I'm using them for is actually to describe local polyhedra data. So the interpretation is very different, and the idea is that local interactions between these objects can give rise to non-perturbative gravity, not just to perturbative gravity as in those other works. And this, of course, brings me to your second question, which is whether there's a twisterial formulation of the continuum theory, and this I have no idea, and this is what I think me and Laurent have been wishing for ever since we saw this connection surfacing at the level of a single graph. So that's extremely interesting. Finally, concerning the conformal picture, it's a tricky issue because it's not so easy on a quantum geometry to decouple the conformal factor from the conformal part of the geometry, and I don't have anything to say that is interesting for the moment in that respect.
Okay, and related to that, you know why I'm asking this question. Is there a natural way to express a gravitational theory which breaks parity, given that the geometry of twisted space before you impose the area matching conditions it breaks parity?
I know why you're asking this question. It's possible to see that, but as I said, the relation with twisters at this stage, I control it at the level of the fixed graph, which is where I do not control the dynamics, apart from the subcase of Regge structures. So in order to give an interesting answer to your question, I would need more, either to control this relation at the continuum level or to understand the dynamics at this discrete level. And unfortunately, I'm still missing both, but I'll get back to you if I do.
Okay, thank you.
More questions?
I have one question. It's me again. In the last part of the talk, Simone, you were discussing the quantization of the constraints starting from twister space.
Yes.
And you showed that there exists, you can actually be solutions corresponding, giving in the end the EPRL solutions, the EPRL constraints on representations. Now, it seems to me that starting from the classical analysis and the understanding of the twister phase space, you are in a much favorable position for studying whether there are other solutions or even to identify what is the largest phase of solutions of the constraints, because you have a full control over the classical theory and a much easier way to quantize it because the synthetic structure is linear initially.
Yeah, that's right. I completely agree. It's one of the potentiality of this formulation. In that respect, I can make a comment that is, if you are in the Euclidean case, for instance, you can also do a representation like this, just of SO4 now in terms of spinors. And there, Etera and Maete have been actually looking at these more general approaches and alternative solutions, which include, instead of taking a Schrödinger-like quantization, taking a Fock-Bargmann quantization. So these are all directions that can be explored also in the Lorentzian case now, thanks to this construction. So yes, I agree with you, it's one of the potentialities to be explored. In a sense, I could say it's what I'm after, in a sense, when I say that I would like to have something that is helping the sum over the spins. It's more like an integral over the phase space pair of classical area and virtual angle. Yeah.
More questions? Okay, let's thank Simone again.